Ladies and gentlemen, the title of my talk is, as you know, the Quranic doctrine of the afterlife. And that could be equally well called the Islamic doctrine of the afterlife, or the Sufi doctrine of the afterlife, because Sufism is the inner aspect of Islam, and Islam as a whole depends totally on the Quran. Now, I should perhaps explain something very briefly about the structure of Islam to start off with. There are three authorities in Islam, but first of all, the incomparably greatest authority is the Quran, that is the revelation. It has the place in Islam that Christ has in Christianity. He is the Word made flesh. The Quran is the Word made book. And next to the Quran are the words spoken outside the Quran, but spoken by God on the tongue of His prophet, where God speaks in the first person. The third authority in Islam, an incomparably lesser authority, are the words spoken by the Prophet himself in the first person about the religion and under the guidance and inspiration. The inspiration of a prophet, of course, is incomparably greater than what we usually understand by the word inspiration. But I will begin my talk with something from the second of those authorities, that is, a word spoken by God on the tongue of the Prophet about himself, not in the Quran. And it is this, it explains to us, in a sense, everything. I was a hidden treasure, and I loved to be known, and so I created the world. That those words explain a very great number of things which need explanation. They tell us, first of all, that the world is nothing other than a mirror which reflects the hidden treasure. That is, that the world, everything in the world, comes from God and is a manifestation of the hidden treasure. Not the treasure itself, but it is a manifestation of the treasure. Now, many of you have heard of Fritjof Schuon, who was, to my mind, the greatest writer of the 20th century. And he has given, it seems to me, the only, well, the true explanation of what is for many people a problem, namely the existence of evil. Because people say, if God is all powerful, why does He not stop evil from, why does He not prevent it from existing, and so on. But the point which he makes is this, and it is very satisfactory. the good God is that this hidden treasure is absolute, infinite, eternal perfection. And the good, it is in the nature of the good to radiate. That is what these words tell us. I was a hidden treasure and I loved to be known. And so there must be radiation. Now, God is all-powerful also. But there is one thing where he has... where there's one limit, an upper limit, to his almightiness. And that is, he cannot stop the hidden treasure from radiating. And radiation produces distance. And after a certain point, distance is dangerous. Now, the most distant thing from the hidden treasure itself, in a certain sense, because we have to understand all sorts of things which appear to be contradictory, because God is present, God is here, wherever we are. But distance becomes dangerous after a certain point. There is no danger until this world is reached. There the danger begins. The next world, that is the world of the paradises, there is no evil there, because they are too near to the divine aura. But it's after the boundary is crossed between this world and the next. And that is what the fall of man refers to, that Adam lost his access to the next world. He was limited to this world. That is the fall of man. It is there that the danger begins. But... and there is evil, but the almightiness of God is always intervening to stop religion, that is, to stop evil. That is what religions are for, to take people to control evil, to teach good, and to take people back in the right direction. Now, in the Quran, there are many indications. It is not understood, of course, the Quran, the function of the Quran is not understood by most academics. It seems to them chaotic and repetitive, but it is unlike the Gospel, where the Word takes the form of a man, the Word made flesh. The Gospels are not revealed. They're not the Word of God. They are sacred history written under inspiration. In Judaism, there are the two, the Bible has two aspects. There is the Pentateuch, that is the revealed book, that is like the Quran, that is direct revelation. And the Psalms also are direct revelation, but most of the Old Testament is, like the New Testament, sacred history written under inspiration, but it is not revelation like the Quran. The Quran is there to teach the religion and as also a form of prayer. One of the great rites of Islam is to read the Quran, to recite the Quran. It is a very powerful sacred rite. Now, there are many refrains in the Quran, that's why it is accused of being repetitive. And one of the refrains is that they're, in a sense, might appear contradictory. There are often seeming contradictions in the sacred books. One of the refrains of the Quran is the wonders of the world, the wonders of this world, as signs of God, because God created the world. They manifest the hidden, their manifestations of the hidden treasure, the sky, the earth, the trees, the rivers, the mountains. They're all things to marvel at. There's a wonderful passage in the Quran, I remember, I could just quote to you offhand, I hadn't intended to quote it, about people who are unmoved by the signs of God, who are not believers. Have they not seen the camels, how they are created? And the heaven, how it is raised aloft? And the earth, how it is spread? That's a passage in the Quran, just an argument, a protestation, a divine protest against unbelief. How could there not be God with all these wonders that you see? That's one of the refrains throughout the Quran, the wonders of this lower world as signs of God. Continual reminding us that certain things, the best things in the world, are signs of God. On the other hand, the theme which contradicts this is the vanity of this lower life, its mediocrity, its continual frustrations, its brevity, a pastime. It is just a pastime and a gain and a game. And then the passage in the Quran, one of the passages goes on, but the world to come, that is life, did they but know. Now the universe, according to the Quran, is a hierarchy of worlds, reflections of the all reflections, all manifestations of the hidden treasure, but growing fainter and fainter. The Quran is full of descriptions of paradise, of the paradises. Vanish when the hidden treasure reabsorbs everything into itself. That is another refrain of the Quran, that everything returns to God. Now there is an immense hierarchy of paradises. The Quran says, or the Prophet himself said, that the people of paradise will behold the high place that is above them, that is the higher paradises, as they now behold the bright planet on the eastern or western horizon. The bright planet is Venus. One sometimes sees Venus after sunset, or after, sometimes at dawn, and that is how the people of one of the lower paradises will see the people above them. But although the paradises are numberless, it is possible to make a division in the hierarchy. Now, in speaking of the afterlife, the Quran, first of all, makes the division between those who are saved and those who are not saved, those who are damned. But then it mentions immediately a third group of people, and it's difficult to translate the word in question, but it means those who are in front. Sometimes translated, not very well translated, but as the winners in the race. Those who are in front, those who are foremost. And they are the highest group of people in the afterlife. And the Quran, first of all, speaks of this group of people who are the foremost. And it says that there are many of them in the earlier generations, but few in the later generations. And it describes what they have in the wonders that they have in paradise. And then it goes on to describe the people who are saved but not among the foremost. Those of the right, they're called those of the right hand, because the right hand is, of course, the benefic side. And they are in many of from the older generations and many from the later generations. The difference between them and the foremost is expressed symbolically by the fact that the foremost are given not only water but also wine to drink, whereas those on the right are given water to drink, but it is of course wonderful water. And there are other distinctions that are made. The foremost are described as being, they are defined even as being brought near to God. And what does that mean? How near? It is a way in Sufism of expressing identity, in fact. The Quran says that God is near, that is to everybody. It is, there's a passage in the Quran which begins, "If my slaves," it's addressed to the Prophet, the Quran is throughout addressed to the Prophet himself, "If my slaves ask thee of me, say I am near." The first thing that God says about himself that is to be told to people that he is near. "I answer the prayer of the prayer when he prayeth." That is what the first thing the Prophet is to be told, is to tell his followers about God. And the foremost have realized that nearness. You could say we are, according to that passage I just quoted in the Quran, but we are all near to God. The mystics of Islam have commented on that. God is near to us. We are far from him. Because in this lower world, it seems to most people that they are very far from God. But those, the foremost, who are described as the near in the passage in the Quran, they are called near because they have realized nearness. They know what it is. That is one. They're also called the slaves of God. Well, everybody is a slave. Even Satan is a slave of God. Everything, every living thing is a slave of God. But you have to put away all mental rigidity in reading a book like the Quran. You haven't got to say this is a contradiction. You have to be very supple. The true slave is one that has realized his state of slavehood. It's something that has to be realized. It has to be learnt. Theoretically, everybody is a slave, but the slaves, the real slaves, are those, the foremost, who have realized what slavehood means. It means, in other words, that they are extinguished in God. All difference between them and God is extinguished. That is the highest possibility, and in all religions we have this possibility as the highest thing, the highest goal to be reached. This, in Islam, it is called slavehood, and it is called nearness. Two things are the same. In Hinduism, the word moksha, which means deliverance, is the word that is used. In Sufism, the word also that is used is tahakkuk in Arabic, which means realization. That is realization of the truth being God himself. Now, I mentioned three groups of people with regard to the afterlife. There is those on the right, that is those who are saved but who are not among the best people, but who are saved. There are those on the left who are the damned, and there are the foremost. But the Quran introduces among those who are saved a third group, which come between those on the right and the foremost. They are called the righteous, and they are given to drink. This is a symbolic description of them. They are given to drink a drink which has been flavored from the two highest fountains in the next world, which only the foremost can approach. The fountains themselves are called Tasneem and Kafur. One of them is flavored with musk, Tasneem, the other is flavored with camphor. And they are able to drink which has been flavored from these two highest fountains. That means that they are following in the footsteps of the foremost. They are on their way themselves to becoming among the foremost. And that is a fourth possibility among those of the next world after death. There is still yet another category of people, because the Quran mentions a certain category of people who are described as being those on the heights, the men on the heights, men used here in the sense of both men and women. In Islam, you have the two words in Arabic, insan, and which means, it is said often in Islam, that a person in the eyes of God is first of all an insan, that is a human being. That is the most important thing. Secondly, he is either a man or a woman. The sex comes second. For God, the first thing is whether the person in question is a human being, that is, either a man or a woman. And the men on the heights, that means women and men, they have already been purified, but they cannot yet enter paradise. They are beyond purgatory. I should say, incidentally, that the Quran makes it perfectly clear that although the dissenters at the end of the Middle Ages, one of the arguments between the Roman Catholics and the Protestants, as you know, was does purgatory exist or not? I remember on one occasion Fritjof Schoen was said, he was talking to a Christian who was belonged to the Orthodox Church. He knew himself, of course, that Protestants don't believe in purgatory. They like to think that everybody goes either to hell or to heaven according to what their life has been. But purgatory is a very central aspect, of course, of the Roman Catholic Church. And in the Orthodox Church, well, this person said to Fritjof Schoen, in the Orthodox Church we have no purgatory. He said, what do you call it then? This is his answer. it is said something absolutely necessary in all religion. There must be a purification before a person is ready to go to heaven. But this passage I'm speaking of now introduces us to a group of people who have passed through purgatory, but they still cannot enter paradise yet. They can see the people of paradise from a distance, and they give them greetings of peace. They can also see the people of hell, but they have not yet entered paradise. Now, this is something which again is to be found in all religions, and a very interesting, very striking example is in this connection Buddhism. Has just the same doctrine as the Quran, but the waiting place there is not on the heights. It is a lotus bud at the edge of paradise. Those who are not yet ready to enter paradise are enclosed in a lotus bud at the very edge of paradise. And as they mature to readiness, the petals of a lotus gradually open. And when the lotus is fully open, then the soul in question is ready to enter paradise. Now one might ask, what is the necessity after purification of waiting in this, having this waiting place? The same category has been mentioned sometimes in Christianity. I forget the details of it, but it is recognized. In fact, Saint Irenaeus in the early Middle Ages pronounced it to be a heresy to say that all those who were saved went straight to paradise. But there has to be, after purgatory, nonetheless, a kind of waiting place. And the reason is this, that it's a fairly obvious reason if we consider the Quran as a whole, because in the descriptions of paradise, the wonderful descriptions of the joys of paradise, it's clear that one of the greatest blessings of paradise, if not the greatest, possibly the greatest, of course, is the nearness of the divine presence. But next to that is the joy of being with the saints in paradise. The saints themselves are, might be described as the greatest joy of paradise. In other words, a soul can only enter paradise if it is ready to be a source of wonder and delight to all the other souls in paradise. That is asking a very great deal, as you will readily admit. So that is why there has to be this waiting place. Now, another point which I should mention, which is very important, one of the chapters of the Quran is very clearly promises that for each soul there will be two paradises. And in that particular chapter of the Quran there are two pairs of paradises are mentioned, but this is just a way of putting it, because clearly the paradises, from all accounts elsewhere in the Quran, are numberless. But the two paradises are necessary because of the twofold nature of man. Man has a vertical aspect and a horizontal aspect. It's significant, there is a passage in the Quran in which God addresses the soul at death, the soul of one who is completely ready for death, who has reached a state of peace. In the Quran, there are three aspects of the soul that is mentioned. There is the soul which commands unto evil, which enjoins upon itself bad things. There is the reproving soul, the soul which has a clear, has a powerful conscience, and which is always reproving itself for doing this and that. And finally, there is the soul which has become complete master of itself, the soul which is at peace. And it is this soul that God addresses in the passage I'm speaking of. O thou soul which art at peace, return unto thy Lord in gladness which is thine and his. Enter thou among my slaves, enter thou my paradise. Now these are the two paradises, the two highest paradises. The paradise which belongs to the slaves, that is the highest group of human beings, which in which all those, that category which I mentioned as the foremost and those who are near to God are in. The second paradise mentioned is the what is called by some Sufis the paradise of the essence. That is, it is God's paradise. It is the hidden treasure itself. Enter thou my paradise means enter into the hidden treasure itself. And in reality, according to other passages of the Quran, the paradises are numberless, but it's possible to make a hierarchy, and there are always, for each soul, as I say, there are two. One paradise where the soul is with the highest of these paradises is where the soul is with all the other greatest of the saints. That is the highest of the created paradises. But the highest of all, of course, is the hidden treasure itself. Now, something has to be said about hell, because just as the Quran's descriptions of paradise are wonderful, so its descriptions of hell are terrible, unsurpassably terrible. They're no worse than they are in Buddhism or in Hinduism or in Christianity, but that is also a superlative. But we may ask ourselves, how is it possible to deserve hell? It is not just for a day or a week, but it is seemingly endless. Well, we can come back later to this question of endlessness, but the point to be asked, the question to be asked by most people, it seems to me, at the first, are we capable of assessing the gravity of sins which our states lived year after year? states such as atheism and agnosticism. The Quran is very clear in saying, I did not create men except that they should worship me. I created man for the purpose that he should worship me. Not to pray is therefore subhuman. The Quran says that such men are lower than animals. Typically a modern man, for example, is worse than even the pagan Arabs who rejected the Quran at first, and they at least believed in God. They didn't believe in the afterlife. They forgot that was the thing that many people came to cease to believe in. When they still believed in God, they stopped believing in the afterlife. They thought death is the end of all things. That was a heresy which grew up among people like the Arabs, that is, after the time of Abraham. Those who maintained the Abrahamic doctrine, because Abraham plays a very powerful part in the Islamic perspective. The Quran says that the religion of Islam is nearer to the religion of Abraham than either Judaism or Christianity. But that is relative, because it doesn't goes on to say that to affirm the validity both of Judaism and of Christianity. But man's greatest gift from God is the power to conceive God. That is, one might say, a sense of the absolute. Man has been given by God the sense of the absolute. That is, the power to distinguish between the absolute and the relative. That is his greatest gift, one might say. And if we look at the modern world, we see that man has become not the representative of God on earth as he was created to be, but a parody of God, a would-be independent tyrant bent on unrestrained exploitation of all the resources of the earth. It is the great betrayal of trust, that. And if hell has a touch of the absolute, it is because this betrayal is in relation to the absolute itself. But hell is not absolute and cannot be eternal. Only God is eternal. The divine name Al-Baqi expresses that. There is a word in Arabic which is sometimes mistranslated as eternal, Khalid, which means lasting. It is used of the people in hell and of the people in paradise, that they are, it's best translated, there they abide. The word to abide is not a bad translation of Khalid. It's never used of God, but only God is eternal. And there's a passage in the Quran which is exceedingly important from our present point of view, that is, in considering hell. The people of hell, the judgment has taken place according to this, already taken place according to this passage in the Quran, and the bad, the evil are in hell, and the good are in paradise. And the evil are in hell, abiding there. But there are two limitations to that state of being in hell. So there, it says, they are in hell, they will be in hell so long as the heavens and the earth endure. And there's an added exception, as it were, except as God wishes. God is ever the doer of what he will. So that there's a double limitation to the endlessness of hell. So long as the heavens and the earth endure, and the other exception is, except God may intervene and take the person in question out of hell if he wishes to do so. Now, there's another passage. The passage goes on to speak about the those who are in paradise, and it says they will remain there. And one might think there's the same limitation to that, but after saying that they will be there as long as the heavens and the earth endure, but then the words are added, it is a gift that shall not be taken away. So that makes a difference between paradise and hell. The people in paradise are promised that what they have been given shall not be taken away from them, whereas the people in hell, they have a limitation. They are not promised this in so many words in the Quran, but nonetheless there is a limitation to hell. Now, there is a saying of the Prophet which seems to me to be a commentary on this passage in the Quran. But I will repeat this, what the Prophet himself said. After the judgment has taken place, and the evil are in hell, the damned are in hell, and the saved are in paradise, have been through purgatory, are purified, and are in paradise. And God will call the angels and the prophets and the believers. He will show them hell, and he will tell them to intercede for the people of hell. And many of the prophets and the saints and the angels will intercede for certain people, and many souls will be taken out of hell. And then, after a time, or there's no time, this is timeless, it is duration, one might say, but it's not temporal duration. Then God orders the angels to bring out of hell all those in whom there is a grain of goodness. And then many, many more people are brought out of hell. And only those are left who have no good to their credit at all. Then he will say, who will intercede for these? And there will be complete silence from the angels. These are the archangels, presumably, because the Quran, like all religions, distinguishes between the archangels, who are those who are brought near to God, in Arabic, al-Malaikat al-Muqarrabun, those who are brought near to God, and the ordinary angels, who are not central beings. God, I will ask the angels and the prophets and the saints, who will intercede for these? And there is no one prepared to intercede. And then he will say, I will intercede because I am the most merciful of the merciful. That is one of the names of God in Islam. So all the souls are brought out of hell, and the saying of the Prophet continues, they're thrown into the waters of the river of life, which flows past the gates of paradise. Then the commentary of the Prophet continues, God will turn to the people of paradise and he will say, are ye content? And they say to him, how should we not be content? And he will say, I will give you better than this. And they say to him, what thing, O Lord, is better? And he will answer, this is very difficult to translate, I will enfold you in my ridwan. The word ridwan means acceptance. The Quran affirms that ridwan is higher than paradise, is more than paradise. It means the God's acceptance of a soul, his pleasure in accepting a soul. He's taking that soul unto himself. That is, of course, taking that soul into the hidden treasure itself. That is why in Islam, in speaking of the prophets and of the saints, it's customary to add the words radiallahu anhu, that is, may God be pleased with him or with her, meaning may he give them his ridwan, that is the highest state, which is beyond paradise. It is a way of actually in mentioning the Prophet, one doesn't say that, one says alayhi salam, which means on him be peace. But of speaking of the saints, one uses the phrase radiyallahu anhum, which means may God give them his ridwan. The prophets already have that in a sense in this life. There is no need to wish for that because they are united with God already in this life. Well, I think that is all I have to say, really, of the Quranic doctrine of the afterlife. It is a return to the hidden treasure, eventually, for all things, because all things are brought back to the hidden treasure from which they came. They are reabsorbed into the hidden treasure. So that is all. Thank you for your patience in listening.
Time to ask some questions, Dr. Ling.
Yes, by all means.